Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in the Psalms. We left off in this Psalm 136. And this psalm is actually a psalm of thanksgiving to God for all of his goodness, you know, to his people, to Israel. But interesting thing, there's 26 verses in this particular psalm. And every verse, it ends with the phrase, "For his loving kindness is everlasting." And I think that it's very, very appropriate in a lot of ways, but I think it says a lot, because when you just start to consider the things that the psalmist is throwing out in terms of, you know, God's creation and things that he has made for man, for mankind, for men's enjoyment and for all their life and survival. But also, he gets into, you know, God's judgments in terms of dealing with his enemies. And after every aspect of judging God's enemies, he continues to say, "For his loving kindness is everlasting." So I think it's kind of unique in the sense that it really emphasizes the fact, you know what? Whatever God does, it's out of righteousness and out of love and loving kindness. You know, and people have to be deep thinkers, but they're just not today. If you really, really begin to reflect upon the loving kindness of God, you would have to come to the conclusion, you know what? Even hell itself is a manifestation of God's love. Now, who could tell me why?
Freedom of choice.
What's that?
Freedom of choice.
Yeah, exactly. Because here's the thing. God could have created every one of us to just be mindless robots, to just be able to just carry out, execute his commandments, his will, you know, his desire flawlessly. But if he created man like that, what would be missing? Obviously love, because we'd be nothing more than robots, right? So, I mean, if you really start to analyze, you know, God's character, you can see that even in judgment, you can see that he's a God of righteousness and justice and love, because you can't separate them. Because if we just begin with verse 1 here, it says, "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Give thanks to the God of gods, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Give thanks to the Lord of the Lords, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who alone does great wonders, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who made the heavens with skill, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who spread out the earth above the waters, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who made the great lights, for his loving kindness is everlasting. The sun and to rule by day, for his loving kindness is everlasting. The moon and the stars to rule by night, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who smote the Egyptians in their firstborn, for his loving kindness is everlasting, and brought Israel out of their midst, for his loving kindness is everlasting. With a strong hand and an outstretched arm, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who divided the Red Sea asunder, for his loving kindness is everlasting. He made Israel pass through the midst of it, for his loving kindness is everlasting. But he overthrew Pharaoh and his armies in the Red Sea, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who led his people through the wilderness, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who smote great kings, for his loving kindness is everlasting, and slew mighty kings, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Shion, king of the Amorites, for his loving kindness is everlasting, and Og, king of Bashan, for his loving kindness is everlasting, and gave their land as a heritage, for his loving kindness is everlasting, even a heritage to Israel, his servant, for his loving kindness is everlasting, who remembered us in our low estate, for his loving kindness is everlasting, and has rescued us from our adversaries, for his loving kindness is everlasting, who gives food to all flesh, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Give thanks to the God of heaven, for his loving kindness is everlasting." Okay, now, like I said, it may seem really redundant, but I think if we just step back and just analyze what's being said here, I mean, it really can speak volumes, because in the very first verse it says, "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good." All right, that's the first thing. It's like God, he's all-powerful. That goes without saying. And just one look out there in the heavens, and you can see that his power is absolutely infinite. But now, just imagine to yourself, what it would be like if a being were all powerful, but he wasn't all goodness. I mean, look at the devil. Thank God he's not omnipotent. You know what I mean? He's not all powerful. Believe me, he's very, very powerful. but it doesn't compare with God's power. To me, it's a comforting thought to know that the person who has all power is all goodness. Look at all these tin-horn dictators throughout the history, and even today, they're all over the place. Look at these people. Look at, let's say, Hitler or Stalin or Mao Zedong. All these guys that wanted to rule the world. It's just amazing if you look around at how people will just claw and lie and cheat and steal to do anything to get their 15 minutes of fame in terms of power, right? But there's not anyone who's good enough to have all power, mm-hmm. except God. So to me, when it says this, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, don't let that go over your head, because just imagine if he wasn't good or wasn't all goodness, and yet he has all power. That would be a pretty frightful thing, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. He says, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his loving kindness is everlasting. He's just saying, hey, it's emphasizing that not only is he all goodness, but he's all love. He's not a God that's driven by hate or, you know, by petty jealousies or this type of thing. No, he's a God whose loving kindness is everlasting. You can bank on it. You can count on it. He doesn't change. He's the same yesterday. He's the same day. He's the same tomorrow. You don't have to worry. You get to heaven. Well, you know, what's going to happen if God gets old and changes, you know? I mean, you know, you don't have to worry about anything like that. He says that verse 2, give thanks to the God of gods, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Now, here's what I'm saying. Give thanks to the God of gods. Well, we all know that Jesus Christ is the King of Kings, is Lord of Lords. He's the God of gods. Now, this world is just absolutely inundated with false gods. I mean, it just is. I mean, over in India alone, they probably got over a million different gods. I mean, and a god doesn't have to be some kind of, you know, totem pole that's overlaid with gold or silver you bow down to. A god could be anything that we put before God. But he's saying this, give thanks to the God of gods. Now, here's the thing, too. When people get into idol worship, we're told very clearly in Deuteronomy chapter 32, and Paul tells us in Corinthians, that when they start worshiping idols, what are they really worshiping?
Demons.
They're worshiping demons. And, you know, when they open that door up, then they've delved into witchcraft. And rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as a sin of idolatry. And once you do that, then the powers of darkness get more and more influence, more and more control over people's lives. I don't care. People, societies, cultures, nations, the world. Just throw it out there. The more men are in rebellion against God, the more these other gods get control, get power. But it's a comforting thought to know that the God whose loving kindness is everlasting is also, you know, the God of gods. There's no appeal after the God of heaven. He says in that verse 3, give thanks to the Lord of lords, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Now, what is Jesus' title in Revelation chapter 19? What's his title? It said,
first and last?
No, that's in Revelation chapter 22.
Lord of lords?
Yes, yes. And it says, and on his robe and on his thigh, he has a name written, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Right? That's one of Jesus Christ's titles, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and the God of Gods. You know, he says here, for his loving kindness is everlasting. And in verse 4, it says, to him who alone does great wonders, for his loving kindness is everlasting. I mean, to me, I just marvel at the wonders that are all just around us. I mean, I always try to devour books or, you know, magazines or videos dealing with nature. And it's just absolutely mind-boggling that not just his power, but his genius, just his incredible imagination. I mean, you just look at, I don't care, just look at the insect world, look at the reptile world, look at the animal world, let's just look at what's in the sea. And you see an imagination that's just infinite. And a creative ability that's just off the charts. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. It says, to him alone who does great wonders. And these wonders, that's why I get so ticked off. It just aggravates the heck out of me when you listen to all this drivel of these atheists that, just somehow try to convince themselves and other people that all of this just happened out of some big bang that just came out of nowhere, and we all just evolved through this slop and sloop and slime and through the zoo all by itself, you know. I mean, to that, that's the ultimate in stupidity. It's the epitome of ignorance. If you really believe that, then you really are a fool. You know, professing to be wise, you become utter fools, because we can't explain the fullness of anything. And I just said, just throw something out there. I don't care. Blade of grass, you know, a glass of water, a stellar galaxy, a subatomic particle, you know, a drop of blood. Try to explain light or darkness. It, just throw something out there, and it's just absolutely amazing how much we don't know about anything. You could take all the learning and the knowledge of all the academic eggheads throughout all history, and all you just put in a little thimble full next to the ocean of what we do not know.
Yeah.
That's why when you look at this, in that verse 4, to him who alone does great wonders, I mean, just look around. And, you know, they really speak of the power of God, the imagination of God, the genius of God. And he says here, for his loving kindness is everlasting. The things that he has created, and you look at the things that he's created, and you can see that they are, you know, created for man's benefit and for his well-being. But then people will say, well, why did he create a mosquito? Why did he create disease? Why did he create this and that and the other thing? Well, I'll tell you what, that wasn't the original design. All this other stuff came lately after the fall, after the rebellion, after the defiance of God's laws. Man brought this on himself. God didn't create this stuff to put a man under a curse. He brought this curse on himself. And he says in that verse 5, he says, to him who made the heavens with skill, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Look out there in the heavens. I mean, we cannot see the end of it. I don't care whether our most powerful telescopes, they cannot see the end of it. And as far out in space that we can see at this particular point in time is about as far out as we will ever see, because they're saying that our universe is now expanding at a velocity that exceeds the speed of light. I mean, if that's the case, then we'll never see the end of it. And he says this, in that verse 6, he says, to him who spread out the earth above the waters, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Now, it says here, they spread out the earth above the waters. What is he referring to?
Land.
Yeah, when the dry land appeared, you know, he separated the waters from the waters, and then the dry land appeared. And that's what he's talking about. And he says in that verse 7, it says, to him who made the great lights, for his loving kindness everlasting, the sun to rule by day, for his loving kindness everlasting, the moon and the stars to rule by night, for his loving kindness everlasting. Now, look what he's saying here, that he made the great lights. And what's the first verse of the Bible? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? And then, what's interesting to me is that on the very first day of creation, and a day, each day that's mentioned there in the book of Genesis says there was morning and there was evening, the first day, morning and evening, the second day, morning and evening, the third day. We're not talking hundreds of billions of years and hundreds of thousands of years and all this other stuff. No, no, no. He did this in 6 days, but the interesting thing, what did he create first?
The light came before the sun was created.
Yes, he said this, the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. So, here's the thing. When people say, look, we can prove to you scientifically that our universe and our solar system and our world and our universe is like 15 billion years old because we can look out there in the heavens and the speed of light travels something like 286,200 miles per second, and that's how long it would take the light from these far-reaching stars to reach us. So therefore, it would take 15 billion years traveling at the speed of light, traveling 6 trillion miles a year. That's how long it would take to reach us. Therefore, our universe has got to be 15 billion years old. And I'm saying, no, no, no. Go back and read when God created the universe. He said the very first thing that he created was light. Then he separated the light from the darkness, and that was day one. But what day did he create the light bearers, the sun, the moon, and the stars? What's that?
Fourth day.
Because I just said that this is what he did on the first day. He separated the light from darkness on the first day. But then it says this. And then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of heaven to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for the season and for the days and the year, and let them be for the lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. And he also made the stars, or he made the stars also. Now here's the thing. Here's what God did. He created darkness and light and then separated the two. All right, and that was on the first day when there were no light bearers. Then on the fourth day, he creates the light bearers. He creates the sun and the moon and the stars. The fourth day. Now, let's just say that you had all power. You had all power. You could do anything you wanted. Let's just say you could. And let's say you walk into a dark room. It's just pitch black. You can't see a thing. You walk into that room. But then you just shine a beam of light into the corner. Just shine a beam of light. And then you create a flashlight. And then you hook that beam of light to the flashlight. And you shine it around. And people say, well, that doesn't happen like that. But I'm saying this. If I were God, and I mean, I have all power, I could do that. That's exactly what he did. He created the light beams, and then he created light bearers, hooked the beam to the light bearers. Mm-hmm. Now, people may scoff at that, but then look at their explanation. It's just absolutely absurd. It's just a big bang out of nowhere and all this. Just read what it's saying here. But in my opinion, and maybe yours too, what do you think is the biggest, the greatest understatement in the Bible? I would say this, and it's not even a full verse. It's just a half a sentence. He said, he made the stars also. Now, is that an understatement?
Yeah.
Is that an understatement? I mean, he made the stars also. Five words. He just threw it out there. He just did this. And how many trillions of stars are out there? We've got 100 billion stars in our galaxy alone, and they're saying that there's over 100 billion galaxies in our universe, and it says that God has named every single star by name. I mean, what kind of God is this? What kind of power is that? What kind of, and he created the sun and the moon and the stars, and that's what he's talking about. And he created out of what? He created out of his love for man, because his loving kindness is everlasting. But just look at our sun. We just got a medium sized sun. It's almost 900,000 miles wide, but we could fit 1.3 million of our Earth into our sun. And the sun, I mean, it's truly, what is it? It's just a gigantic fusion reactor. I mean, the surface of the sun reaches like 10 million degrees, but then the very core of the sun is like 27 million degrees. Can you imagine that? What kind of power is that? And then you got these solar flares, I mean, that can shoot millions of miles out into space, you know, over a million miles, and then come back down. That is power. That is power that is beyond our ability to be able to really comprehend. It really is. You know what I'm saying?
I got to say something before I forget. When you said the thing about the light being created first in the darkness, that really does confirm and back up that the idea that God, you know, that God created the universe and everything with the appearance of
Age. Yes.
Because it was instantaneous. He created the light. All of that energy, everything, there was no energy being transferred. It was just created it all.
Yeah.
Instantly.
Right. But like I've said many times, when God created the universe, there's just a natural built-in appearance of age. Mm-hmm. And so when these guys come up with all their dating processes, they're forgetting one big thing. All right? That everything was created with age. And the reason I say that is, I use Adam as an example every single time. You know, when God created Adam from the dust of the ground, he created him, he formed him, he fashioned him, and then he breathed into him, and then man became a living soul. You could get all the academic educators, you get all the scientists, you get all the doctors, you get everybody, all the experts you could possibly get together, and you could bring Adam to them and say, now how old is this man? Scientifically, how old is this man? And they could take all the measurements and all their learning and say, well, he appears to be about a 30-year-old man. Well, wait a minute. He's only 30 minutes old. Mm-hmm. See? It's the built-in appearance of age. Same thing with the universe. Same thing with everything God has created. You see, this is what people don't... I don't know. Either they don't think things through, or they just don't want to believe it. And so they come up with all these cockamamie theories as to how it all began, because they do not want to be accountable to this God, all right, whose loving kindness is everlasting, but also he's a God not to be trifled with. You know, he's a God to be feared and revered and obeyed. But now here's the thing about the sun and the moon and the stars, and you got to understand that what is God going to do in the end when men are to continually rebel against him? God is going to use these very things to judge men, these very things to judge the world. No less than a dozen times in Scripture we are told that someday our sun is going to go out, and it appears that it's going to nova. And I know people will scoff at that, saying, well, if our sun novas, it's just going to incinerate our earth. But you got to understand, this is divinely controlled, because it says this in the Revelation chapter 16. He says here, the fourth angel poured out his bowl upon the sun, and it was given to it to scorch men with fire, and men were scorched with fierce heat, and they blasphemed the name of God who has the power over these plagues, and they did not repent or to give him glory. And then the fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and his kingdom became darkened, and they gnawed their tongues because of pain, and they blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and they did not repent of their deeds. Now here's the thing, these judgments are coming back to back towards the very end of the tribulation period, and I believe it's going to happen 3 days before Jesus Christ literally physically returns to the earth, that this angel is going to pour out his bowl upon the sun is going to nova, it's going to scorch men with intense heat, but then in my opinion, it's going to cave in on itself, and it's going to become a black hole. And again, I know that people are just going to scoff, they're going to mock, but I'll tell you what, when you understand that this is a judgment from God and that he is in total complete control, this God is all powerful, then you can't come up with all your theories to negate that, because it says this in Revelation chapter 7, and I looked and he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood. And the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind, and the sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. Then the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves among the rocks and the mountains, and they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall upon us and hide us from the presence of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand. Interesting thing is that if you go back to the very first book of the Bible, you know, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and you go to the very last book of the Bible, God is talking about the sun and the moon and the stars, but now they're going to be used as God as instruments of judgment, but he created them as instruments of his loving kindness to provide men with, you know, all of their needs. I mean, our sun, it's like I said, it's almost 1 million miles wide. If we were just a little closer or a little further away, we'd either burn up or freeze. You just look at his creation, and you gotta just sit there with your mouth open saying, my God, this God of heaven, you can't wrap your mind around him in terms of his power. That's why it's so important to him that we believe with faith, all right? Because his power blinds us. But, you know, in Revelation chapter 10, when this angel that John sees who's standing on 1 foot on the sea and 1 foot on the earth, and his legs or his feet are on fire, and he's clothed with a rainbow, and, you know, his face is shining like the sun, he said this, and the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land lifted up his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created the heaven and the things in it, and the earth and the things in it, and the sea and the things in it, there will be no longer any delay. You go back to the last book of the Bible, and it really emphasizes God's creation. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, especially now you can see it, and I think it's going to be even more intense in the tribulation period, where men are just going to be continued to deny the God of heaven his rightful place of honor when it comes to his creation and his power and his genius. So that's why this angel is swearing to the God of heaven who created the heavens, who created the earth, who created the sea, who created everything in it, right? Because men scoff at that today, and they scoff at anybody who proclaims that today, you know. But What did Jesus Christ say about the Son? He said this in Matthew chapter 24. He says, "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds and from one end of the sky to the other." That's the thing, man. Jesus Christ himself said, our Son is going to go out. God is going to use this as a chastening rod. He says this in Luke chapter 21. It says, "There will be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars, and on the earth dismay among nations and perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting from fear and the expectation of things which are coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. But when these things begin to take place, straighten up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near." And for anybody who's wondering, man, why is God going to allow his people to go through this? Well, understand this. This is what Jesus Christ said in Luke. He said this: "Be on guard so that your hearts will not be weighed down with dissipation or drunkenness and the worries of life. And that day will come upon you suddenly like a trap, and it will come upon all those who dwell upon the face of the earth." Now listen to this. "But keep on the alert at all times, praying that you may have the strength to escape all these things that are about to take place and stand before the Son of Man." Now, what's he referring to here?
Rapture.
The rapture. Rapture. You won't find the word rapture in the Bible. But Jesus Christ is saying very clearly, listen, all these things are going to happen, but he said this, keep on the alert. Look what, there's so many people, man, they're just being lulled to sleep, man, by the powers of darkness. "Keep on the alert at all times, praying that you may have the strength to escape all these things that are about to take place and stand before the Son of God, the Son of Man." See, we got to be in prayer. We got to be really in a state of living for God at the time that he returns, right? Now, if Jesus Christ returned right now, right this second, I believe that everyone in this room would love his appearing. At least I hope I would. You know what I mean? All right. But if we're all out there robbing a bank, I don't think we're going to love his appearing. And I don't think we're going to go anywhere. You know, we're going to stay right here. All right. It doesn't mean we can't be saved during the tribulation period, but it does mean now we're under God's judgment. Remember in Matthew chapter 25, there were five foolish virgins and five wise virgins. And the five foolish ones, they weren't prepared to meet him. They didn't have enough oil in their lamps. The five wise ones were prepared. But interesting thing, I've said this many times, one of the most fascinating things about that parable that Jesus Christ gave in Matthew chapter 25 about the 10 virgins, it says they all fell asleep. All of them. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that suggest to you?
The ones that were prepared weren't really expecting
them. Yes. See, that's the thing. See, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not setting any dates, but I am saying this. I'm convinced through Scripture and through current events and through everything that Christ and the apostles and the prophets have foretold, I'm convinced that Jesus Christ is going to return in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. Now, I could walk out of here and get run over by a cement truck and that would be the end of me, all right? I'm not saying that I'm going to live to see his return, but I believe that my generation will be the one, you know, to live to see everything take the place, right? Mm-hmm. I believe that, you know, that through Scripture and everything that's being said, all right?
Because weren't you born in the year that Israel became a nation?
Well, yes. Yes, I was. I was. They became a nation again in May of 1948, and I was born in July of 1948. So you know what an old man I am. But he did say this. He said it in Luke. He said it in Matthew. He says, "Learn a parable from the fig tree. When its branches are tender and puts forth leaves, you know that the summer is near, or the end is near." And he said this: "Truly, truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things be fulfilled." All right? Now, people can argue from now the cows come home, now the hell freezes over, now the, you know, the crack of doom. Well, what's a generation? And all I'm just simply saying is this. If you look at what it says in Psalm 91, that 70 years are given man because of strength, some may live to be 80. Well, you understand that I think that the average lifespan, even in the most technologically advanced countries in the world, it still hovers in that ballpark between 70 and 80. Now, granted, more people are living to be 100, but still, you got the overall average. It's even less than that when you consider all of the mortality rates throughout the world, especially in third world countries and whatnot. And my point is that the five wise virgins were ready. All right, they were prepared. They were on guard. All right, but they all fell asleep. And here's what I'm trying to get at, is that, you know, I believe Jesus Christ can return in my lifetime. But I will bet you $1,000 he does not return before this Bible study is over. Anybody want to take me up on that?
Well, if he does, we won't
have to pay. Well, maybe I'll be left behind with you. But you understand what I'm saying? I believe he's going to return in my lifetime. But I don't believe he's going to return tonight. Therefore, I'm asleep. Got it? They all fell asleep. They were all expecting it, right? But the five wise ones were prepared, even though they fell asleep, in the terms of they weren't expecting it that minute, because Jesus Christ says, I'm coming at a time when you least expect.
Least expect it.
And he said, at midnight, a cry went out at midnight that the bridegroom was coming. Right?
Right. 2 o'clock our time, by the way.
Yes.
2 o'clock.
Well, you know, I never read this in any commentary, but I looked at what Jesus Christ said there, and I said, you know what? That midnight would have to be in Jerusalem or Israel. Now, I could be wrong. I'm not trying to be dogmatic about that. But he said this, and while the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at midnight, there was a shout. Behold the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. Mm-hmm. Now, that shout is what?
Archangel?
Yes, with the voice of an archangel. That's the shout. My people come up here with a trumpet of God. It says this, but at midnight there was a shout, behold the bridegroom, behold the bridegroom, come out to meet him. Now, you know, I wish it said come up to meet him, but it said come out to meet him, right? My point is this, all right, is that I believe it's going to be midnight in Jerusalem. Now, I could be wrong, okay? But
how far ahead of us are they?
What's that?
13 hours.
It would be 2 o'clock in the afternoon, our time.
2 o'clock.
Unless it's daylight savings, then it might be what, 3 or 1.
It would be 2 o'clock. But my point is simply this: yeah. Is that who do you think is going to be affected more by it? Well, what I mean by it, let's just say the rapture happens, all right? Now, if it's 2 o'clock our time, I think it's going to have a more devastating effect upon our country, you know, because if, let's just say, a few million people just disappear, well, you know, it wouldn't be so devastating, let's just say, if it was at midnight our time, because there's not that many people on the roads and all these other type of things going on. Anyway, I know I'm getting way off on a tangent here. I didn't mean to get so far off, but I'm just simply saying that you look at what he's saying here about the sun and the moon and the stars and how it's all going to come into focus in the last, basically as a judgment, all right, at the end of the world. And there's going to be this global earthquake that's going to be apparently triggered by when our sun goes out. And it's going to be absolutely horrendous what's coming. Now, I know I've got to pick up the pace here, because it says here in verse 10, it says, to him who smote the Egyptians in their firstborn, for his loving kindness is everlasting. So, see what I'm saying here? In the first 9 verses, he's dealing with God's creation and why he should be praised, and his loving kindness is everlasting. And you could see his loving kindness in his creation, how he's created everything for the well-being of man and mankind, right? But now we're going to get into his judgments, but it's still his loving kindness. It's everlasting. In other words, simply because God brings down judgment upon man or mankind, upon this world, upon a nation or a society, a country, whatever, it doesn't mean that he's no longer loving. So he says this, to him who smote the Egyptians in their firstborn, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Well, why did he smite the Egyptians?
Because they were defiant.
Well, not only that, but because of their wickedness, all right? And he's going to go on here and name all these different kings that God also had destroyed. But people have to be, I think, mature thinkers, all right? There's too many shallow, fuzzy thinkers, man, who's self-righteous ignoramuses who just always attack the Bible and God as being, hey, man, God perpetrated all this genocide and all this war and all this bloodshed. Hey, back the train up here, because this is what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 9. And God said this, "Know therefore today that it is the Lord your God who is crossing over before you as a consuming fire. He will destroy them and he will subdue them before you so that you may drive them out and destroy them quickly, just as the Lord has spoken to you. Do not say in your heart when the Lord your God has driven them out before you, 'Because of my righteousness the Lord has brought me in to possess this land,' but it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is dispossessing them before you. It is not for your righteousness or for the uprightness of your heart that you are going to possess their land, but it is because the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God is driving them out before you in order to confirm the oath which the Lord swore to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc." Now, here's the thing. Just imagine that these people in Cana, you know, all these different nations that were in Cana in terms of the Hittite and the Hevite and the Jebusite and the Amorite and the Canaanite and all these other, if all these people were making an honest attempt to live lives that were glorifying and honoring to God, it doesn't mean that they were perfect by any means, but they were really making an honest attempt, you know, to honor God, to glorify God, and to live up to the light that he put into their conscience, would he have them destroyed? You know, I think a child with an IQ of 2 could figure that out. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, you got to look at what it's saying here, right? So when he's talking about he's destroying all these nations and these people, it's because of their wickedness, you see, but his loving kindness continues to go on forever. It doesn't mean that he's a capricious God. He just gets up one morning and says, "Well, I'm in a bad mood today. I'm just going to knock some heads together." No, he's not like that at all. It says this in verse 11 of Psalm 136. He says, "And he brought Israel out from their midst, for his loving kindness is everlasting, with a strong hand and an outstretched arm, for his loving kindness is everlasting." Now, just apply this today. Instead of Israel, you can say, "And God brought his people out from the midst of the world, for his loving kindness is everlasting," right? He's redeemed us from this world that's under a divine curse. He says this in verse 13, "To him who divided the Red Sea asunder, for his loving kindness is everlasting. And he made Israel pass through the midst of it, for his loving kindness is everlasting. And he overthrew Pharaoh and his army in the Red Sea, for his loving kindness is everlasting." Now, here's the thing. He's talking about what God did to the Egyptians and how he led his people through the Red Sea. But in the New Testament, Paul refers to this Red Sea as being what? When they passed through it.
Baptism.
He said this in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. "For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock from which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness." See, God, his loving kindness is everlasting, but, you know, he's going to deal with people whether they're his people or not, and these people were just rebellious, so he judged them. And God told these people, he said, "Look, I'm having these people destroyed because of their wickedness, but if you start acting like them, I'm going to destroy you too. I'm going to throw you out of the land." So God's no respecter of persons. He doesn't show any partiality, right? "There will be tribulation and distress for every soul of man that does evil, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." And there's going to be glory and honor and praise to everyone who does good, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Paul tells us that in Romans. So you got to look at what God is saying here and understand where he's coming from. Well, he's talking about what he did in terms of the Red Sea. And he drowned this entire Egyptian army in the Red Sea. But, you know, we're not talking about the world that's going to experience these 10 plagues on a global scale. Mm-hmm. All right? Everything that happened to Egypt is going to happen to the world. I mean, all the fresh water and the sea is going to turn to blood. There's going to be, you know, demonic frogs that are going to go forth perpetrating a war that you won't believe. There's going to be pestilence in terms of gnats and flies, and there's going to be all kinds of diseases, even on animals, and it's going to be the boils or the loathsome sores upon men who take the mark, and it's going to be hail mixed with fire in terms of 100-pound hailstones generated by nuclear fires, and also there's going to be the locust that's mentioned in, that happened in Egypt. There's going to be this, the demonic locusts that are let out of the bowels of hell, and men won't see these locusts, but they will spread some kind of disease or pandemic where men are going to try to die, but God, but death is going to flee from them. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a judgment for God, because men feel like, well, you know, we're going to play God. If somebody's suffering, just put them down like a horse. Boom. Well, God's going to show during this period of time where people are really suffering that now they can't die.
Yep.
You know, it's going to be supernatural. Also, there was 3 days of darkness in Egypt, over Egypt. But there's going to be darkness over the whole world, and I believe it's going to be for 3 days. And then, of course, there was the death of the firstborn, and it's going to be a situation where God says in Isaiah chapter 13 that he's going to make men scarcer than gold, scarcer than a pure gold of Ophir. That's how the population of the world is going to be so radically reduced because of all of the judgments that are about to come upon it. And that Pharaoh's army was drowned in the Red Sea, but I believe that very strongly that when you read in the Revelation, there's going to be a situation where, what are you going to see? We are told in Revelation chapter 14 that there's going to be a river of blood that's going to flow for 200 miles, the height of a horse's bridle. What does it say? Revelation chapter 14, it says this: and another angel, the one who has power over fire, came out from the altar, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle into the earth and gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth and threw them into the great wine press of the wrath of God, and the wine press was trotted outside the city, and the blood came out from the wine press up to a horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. Now here's the thing. What's the wine press? I've said it many times.
Judgment.
It's Armageddon, Armageddon, Armageddon. When you have multitudes, multitudes, multitudes in the Valley of Decision down there, right? You could have as many as 500 million men down there, because every nation on earth is God's going to bring down there. I'm not talking about everybody in the world, but every nation on earth is going to be represented down there with an army. But when the world is plunged into total darkness and the sky opens up like a scroll or rolls back like a scroll and everybody sees Jesus Christ coming on a white horse with all the armies of heaven behind him, he's coming, and people are going to be terrified who are not ready to meet him. They're going to be hiding, trying to hide. You know, they're going to hide, go into the mountains, to the cliffs and the rocks, and saying, pleading with the mountains and the rocks to fall upon them and crush them into oblivion, because to hide them from the wrath of the Lamb and from him who sits upon the throne. But the armies of Armageddon, when they see him coming, we are told in Revelation chapter 13, what are they going to do when they see him coming?
Turn their guns on Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in that Revelation chapter 19, when you read about him coming, he says, I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse, against his army. When they see Christ coming, they're actually going to turn their guns on him. But Jesus Christ, he has this sword that comes out of his mouth, which is what?
Word of God.
It's symbolic for his word. It's a two-edged sword. He's just going to speak the word and expunge every last drop of blood out of their veins. And you're talking about a river of blood. So there's going to be another Red Sea where they're going to drown in their own blood. You got it? You get it?
Some parallels there.
That's what I'm saying. It's easy to read this and have it go over your heads. It really is. But if you analyze what's being said here, it's more up to date than tomorrow's newspaper, because he said this in that verse 16, to him who led his people through the wilderness, for his loving kindness is everlasting. And Christ is leading us through a wilderness. This world is a wilderness. It's a spiritual wilderness. But if we remain faithful and true to him, he's leading us and guiding and directing us. But he's the one that said, my sheep know me and I know them. Why?
They hear my voice.
Because they hear my voice. And why? They follow me. See?
Yep.
If we follow Christ, we hear his voice, we follow him, guess what? He's leading us through this wilderness. He's leading us to heaven. And verse 17, to him who smote great kings for his loving kindness is everlasting. He slew mighty kings for his loving kindness is everlasting. Shion, the king of the Amorites, for his loving kindness is everlasting. And Og, king of Bashan, for his loving kindness is everlasting. And gave their land as a heritage for his loving kindness is everlasting. So he smote these kings, you know, the Amorites, the king of Bashan, or Og, or the Cheyenne, all these people, their nations were wicked and they were evil. They were steeped in their eyeball, up to their eyeballs and idol worship and murder and immorality and godlessness and idolatry. What?
Child sacrifice.
Child sacrifice, this type of thing, right? Mm-hmm. But when he says this, that verse 21, and gave their land as a heritage for his loving kindness everlasting. Well, how does this apply to us? Jesus Christ said it in the Beatitudes.
We get to go to heaven, or we get to see heaven.
And the meek will inherit the earth. Well, and also there's the promised land in heaven, okay? Mm-hmm. And then it says in verse 22, even a heritage to Israel, his servant, for his loving kindness is everlasting. You know, it's the meek they're going to inherit this earth, not the high and the mighty, you know. You know, and then verse 23, who remembered us in our low estate, for his loving kindness is everlasting. This is the thing that, you know, God is just attracted to a humble soul, like a magnet. But he will resist the proud. Well, you know, he says, who remembered us in our lowly state. When we turn to God and, well, with a repentant heart and humility, he can't resist that. But if we're just going to be proud, we're going to be stubborn, we're going to be arrogant, we're going to be defiant, believe me, we're our own worst enemy. And he says in verse 24, and he has rescued us from our adversaries. Look at this. What are our adversaries? Well, it's the powers of darkness. They're all over us. He has rescued us from our adversaries, who gives food to all flesh, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Give thanks to the God of heaven, for his loving kindness is everlasting. That last verse, 26, it's almost like it's two bookends, because read that first verse again. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his loving kindness is everlasting. Look at this last verse. Give thanks to the God of heaven, for his loving kindness is everlasting. I mean, it's like two bookends. But here's the thing. When it's talking about, you know, God is the one who provides food for all flesh. It doesn't matter, animal, reptile, insects, this type of thing. We're all dependent upon God. There's not a creature on the face of this planet that's not dependent upon God. But now, here's the thing, too. Just keep this in mind. I'm going to close with this thought. I hope I'm not out of time yet. I think I got a couple minutes. And when it talks about your adversaries, we got to understand what we're dealing with today. Because people, I think, have a misconception. We're talking about this God of love, but you've got to really look at the life of Jesus Christ and understand where he was coming from. Because when you look at Jesus Christ, when he went toe-to-toe with the hypocrites and people who were really defying against God and his moral laws, he called them hypocrites, he called them blind guides, he called them fools or blind men, or he said that they were full of robbery and self-indulgence. He said they were like whitewashed tombs and full of dead man's bones. He said that they were full of lawlessness. He said they were sons of murderers. He said they were wolves in sheep's clothing. He said that their father is the devil, that he called them liars. Now, does that sound like a God who is completely tolerant and inclusive and understand, and a God who can't get wrought up or angry about anything? Mm-hmm. We got to understand that, you know what? We've just read this whole psalm here, and everything, including God's judgment, says his love is everlasting. But he's also, you know, a God of truth. Jesus Christ referred to himself as the truth, right? Mm-hmm. And that God is love. But you had to understand that, hey man, simply because God is love, that doesn't negate the fact that he's a just God, a righteous God, and he's going to punish evil, and we got to live up to what he's telling us. But see, here's the thing. If God is a God who does not punish evil, he's not a good God. In other words, he's amoral. He doesn't care what you do. You can go out there and mass murder 1,000 people. He doesn't care. Well, wait a minute. Then he can't be good. He can't be all goodness.
Yeah.
Right? That he would condone this wickedness. So his goodness is going to compel him to judge this wickedness.
Right.
See, to me, it's just logic. It's just common sense. Anybody have anything you want to add or share? Yeah.